Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone and J.A. Johnstone's Savage Texas. Narrated by Terrence Aselford. With performances by David Coyne, Danny Gavigan, Bradley Smith, Casey Platt, Michael Glenn, David Harris, Scott McCormick, Evan Casey, Tracy Lynn Oliveira, Alyssa Wilmoth, Thomas Keegan, Eric Messner, Richard Rowan, James Lewis, Tim Carlin, Gary Tells, Dylan Lynch, Nanette Savard, Jonathan Watkins, Tim Pabone, Christopher Graybill, Tim Getman, Kimberly Gilbert, Drew Copas, Michael John Casey, Colleen Delaney, and Mort Shelby. Savage Texas Number 2, A Good Day to Die. On a night in late May, 1866, Comanche Chief Red Hand took up the fire lance to proclaim the opening of the warm weather raiding season. A time of torture, plunder, and murder. For warlike Comanche braves, the best time of the year. 600 and more Comanche men, women, and children were camped near a stream in a valley north of the Texas Panhandle, on land between the Canadian and Arkansas rivers. The site, Arrowhead Rock, lay deep in the heart of the vast, untamed territory of Comancheria, home ground of the tribal nation. The gathering was made up mostly of two main subgroups, the Bison Eyes and the Dawn Hawks, along with a number of lesser clans, relations, and allies. Red Hand, a Bison Eye, was a rising star who had led a number of successful raids in recent seasons past. Many braves, especially those of the younger generation, were eager to attach themselves to him. Others had come to hear him out and make up their own minds about whether or not to follow his lead. Not a few had come to keep a wary eye on him and see what he was up to. All brought their families with them, from the oldest squaws to the youngest babes in arms. They brought their teepees and personal belongings, horse herds, and even dogs. The camp on the valley stream was unusual in its size, the tribesmen generally preferring to travel in much smaller groups. The temporary settlement had come into being in response to Red Hand's invitation, taken by his emissaries to the various interested parties. Invitation, not summons. A high-spirited individual, the Comanche brave was jealous of his freedom and rights. His allegiance was freely given and just as freely withdrawn. Warriors of great deeds were respected, but not slavishly submitted to. A leader gained followers by ability and success. It was a mark of Red Hand's prowess that so many had come to hear his words. The campsite at Arrowhead Rock lay on a well-watered patch of grassy ground. Cone-shaped teepees massed along the stream banks. Smoke from many cooking fires hazed the area. The teepees had been given over to women and children. The men were elsewhere. Packs of half-wild, half-starved dogs chased each other around the campgrounds. The horse herds were picketed nearby. Comanches reckoned their wealth in horses, as white men did in gold. The greater the thief, the more he was respected and envied by his fellows. For such a conclave, an informal truce reigned, whereby the braves of various clans held in check their craving to steal each other's horses, mostly. North of the camp, a long bowshot away, the land dipped into a shallow basin, a hollow serving as a kind of natural amphitheater. It was spacious enough to comfortably hold the 200 and more warriors assembled there under a horned moon. No females were present in the basin. To a man, they were in prime physical condition. There was no place in the Comanche Nation for weaklings. Men were warriors, doing the hunting, raiding, fighting and killing, sometimes dying. Women did all the other work, the drudgery of the tribe. The braves were high-spirited, raucous. Much horseplay, boasting, and big brags occurred. It had been a long winter. They looked forward to the wild, free life of raiding south with eager anticipation. An air of keen interest hung over them as they waited impatiently for Red Hand to take the fore. At the northern center rim of the basin stood a triangular-shaped rock about 20 feet high. Shaped like an arrowhead planted point up in the ground, it gave the site its name. Among Comanche warrior society, the arrowhead was an emblem of power and danger, giving the stone an aura of magical potency. A fire blazed near its base. Between the fire and the rock, a stout wooden stake, 8 feet tall, had been driven into the ground. The braves faced the rock, bison eyes grouped on the left, dawn hawks on the right. Both clans were strong, numerous, and well-respected. Nearly evenly matched in numbers and fighting prowess, they were great rivals. A stir went through the crowd. Something was happening. A handful of shadowy figures stepped out from behind the rock, coming into view of those assembled in the hollow. They ranked themselves in a line behind the fire, forming up like a guard of honor in advance of their leader. Underlit by the flame's red glare, they could be seen and recognized. Mighty warriors all, men of renown, they made up Red Hand's inner circle of trusted advisors and henchmen, his lieutenants. Ten Scalps was a giant of a man, one of the strongest warriors in the Comanche Nation. He'd taken 10 scalps as a youth during his first raid. After that, he stopped counting. Sundog, his face wider than it was long, had dark eyes glinting like chips of black glass. Little Bells, with twin strings of tiny silver bells plated into his lion's mane of shoulder-length hair, stood tall. Badger was short and squat, with tremendous upper body strength and oversized paw-like hands. Black Robe, clad in a garment he'd stripped from a Mexican priest he'd slain and scalped, was next. Part long coat, part cape, the tattered garment gave him a weird, bat-like outline. The five stood motionless, faces impassive, arms folded across their chests. They held the pose for a long time, their stillness contrasting with the crowd's mounting excitement. After a moment, a lone man emerged from behind the rock into the firelight. He wore a war bonnet and carried a lance. The bison-eyed clansmen vented loud, full-throated cries of welcome, for the newcomer was none other than their own great man, Red Hand. But Red Hand's entrance was almost as well received by the rival Dawn Hawks. He was a man of power, a doer of great deeds. He had stature. He had stolen many horses, enslaved many captives, killed many foes. With skill and daring, he had won much fame throughout the plains and deep into Mexico. Circling around to the front of Arrowhead Rock, Red Hand scrambled up onto a ledge 4 feet above the ground. Facing the assembled, he showed himself to them. Roughly 30 years of age, he was in full vigorous prime, broad-shouldered, deep-chested, and long-limbed. Thick, coal-black hair, full and unbound, framed a long, sharp-featured face. His eyes were deep-set and burning. He was crowned with a splendid eagle-feather war bonnet, whose train reached down his back. He wore a simple breechcloth and knee-length antelope-skin boots. A hunting knife hung on his hip. From fingertips to wrists, the backs of his hands were painted with greasy red coloring, markings that were stripes, wavy lines, crescent moons, and arrows. His right hand clenched the lance, holding it upright with its base resting atop the rocky ledge. 10 feet long, it was tipped with a wickedly sharp, barbed spear blade. This was no Comanche war spear. He had taken it in Mexico the summer before from a mounted lancer, one of the legions of crack cavalry troops sent by France's Emperor Napoleon III to protect his ally Maximilian of Austria-Hungary. Red Hand knew nothing of the crowned heads of Europe, nor of Napoleon III's mad dream of a new world empire that had prompted him to install a Habsburg royal on the throne of Mexico. Red Hand knew killing, though, dodging the lancer's lunging spear thrust, dragging him down off his fine horse, cutting his throat. Word of this enviable weapon spread far and wide among the Comanches. More than a prize, the lance became a talisman of Red Hand's prestige. It evoked no small interest, with many braves pressing forward, craning for a better look. Red Hand lifted the weapon, shaking it triumphantly in the air. Notably lacking in enthusiasm was Watonka, a Dawnhawk's chief standing in the front rank of his clan. He too was a great man, with many daring deeds of blood to his credit, but he was 50 years old, a generation older than Red Hand. Of medium height, Watonka was lean and wiry, all bones, sinews, and tendons. His hair, parted in the middle of his scalp, was worn in two long, gray-flecked braids. His face was deeply lined, his mouth downturned and dour. Red Hand's enthusiastic audience did nothing to lighten his mood. Others were not as constrained as he was in their appreciation of the upstart, Watonka noticed, including many of his own Dawnhawks. Too many. The young men were loud in their whooping and hollering, and a number of older, more established warriors also stamped and shouted for Red Hand. Watonka cut a side glance at Laughing Bear standing beside him. Laughing Bear was of his generation, himself a mighty warrior, though with few deeds in recent years to his credit. He was Watonka's kinsman and most trusted ally. Laughing Bear was heavy-set, with sloping shoulders and a blocky torso, thick in the middle. His features were broad and lumpish. The gaze of his small round eyes was bleak. He looked as if he had not laughed in years. Red Hand's appearance this night had not struck forth in him any spirit of mirth. He shared Watonka's grave concerns about the growing Red Hand problem. The hero of the hour basked for a moment in the gusty reception given him before motioning for silence. Red Hand looked across the throng.
Brothers, I went in search of a vision. I went in search of a vision, and I have found it.
Red Hand's face split in a wicked grin, showing strong white teeth.
In the old times, life was good. The game was thick. Birds filled the skies. The buffalo were many, covering the ground as far as the eye could see.
He had a far-off look in his eyes, as if gazing through the distance of space and time in search of such one-time abundance. He frowned, his gaze hardening, dark passions clouding his features.
Then came the white men.
The mood of the braves turned, accompanied by much solemn nodding of heads in agreement. Red Hand was voicing their universal complaint against the hated invaders, destroyers of a cherished way of life.
First were the Mexicans, with their high-handed ways.
He thrust his lance toward the south, the direction from which the initial trespassers hailed.
They came in suits of iron, calling themselves conquerors. They rode horses.
Red Hand's eyes bulged as he assumed an expression of pop-eyed amazement.
We had never seen horses before. The horses were good. We killed the men and took their horses. We burned the settlements and killed until only cowards were left alive. And we sent them running back to Mexico. From that day till now, they have never dared return to our hunting grounds. We could have wiped them off the face of the earth, chasing them into the great water, had we so desired. Aye, for we Comanche are a mighty folk, and a warlike one. But we were merciful. We took pity on the poor, weak creatures, and let them live, so they could keep on breeding fine horses for us to steal. One black day, out from where the sun rises, came the Texans.
Texans, the Comanche's generic term for Anglos, English-speaking whites.
Texans! They, too, wanted to steal our land and enslave us. They had guns. The guns were good. So we killed the Texans and took their guns, and killed more, whipping and burning, until they wept like frightened children. Not all did we kill, for we Comanches are a merciful people. We let some live, so we could take more guns and powder and bullets from them. Their horses are good to steal too, and their women. But the Comanche is too tender-hearted for his own good. For a time, all was well, but no more. The Texans forget the lesson we taught them in blood and fire. They come creeping back, pressing at our lands in ever greater numbers. They will eat up the earth if they are not stopped. What to do, brothers? What to do? I prayed to the Great Spirit to send me an answer, and I dreamed a dream. The sky cracked open, the clouds parted, and an arm reached down between them. A mighty red arm, holding a burning spear. The Fire Lance! The hand darted the spear. It flew down to earth, striking the ground with a thunderclap. When the smoke cleared, I alone was left standing. For all around me, the Texans lay fallen on the ground. Man, woman, and child, dead. Dead all, from the oldest to youngest, from greatest to most small. All dead. And this was the least of wonders. Everywhere a white person had fallen, a buffalo rose up. Here, there, everywhere a buffalo. They filled the plains with a thundering herd, filling my heart with joy. So it was shown to me in a dream, as I tell it to you. But I tell you this, it was no dream, but a vision, a true vision. The Great Spirit has shown us the way. Kill the Texans! Take up the Fire Lance! Kill and burn until the last white has fled from these lands, never to be seen again. The buffalo will once more grow thick and fat. All will be well as in the days of our fathers!
Brandishing his lance, Red Hand shook it at the heavens. He hopped down off the ledge that had served him as a platform and stepped back into the shadows, partly withdrawing from the scene while the disturbance played itself out. His henchmen followed. Presently, the braves settled down in their restless way. Red Hand put his head together with his five-man cadre, giving orders. Carrying out his command, Sun Dog and Little Bells moved around to the east side of Arrowhead Rock, where a lone teepee stood off by itself in the gloom beyond the firelight. Sundog lifted the front flap and went inside. A moment later, a figure emerged headfirst through the opening as if violently flung outward, falling face down in the dirt at Little Bells' feet. Sundog reappeared. He and Little Bells bracketed a sorry figure. They grabbed him by the arms and hauled him to his feet. The newcomer was a white man in cavalry blue, a long knife, one of the hated pony soldiers. The captive wore a torn blue tunic and pants with a yellow stripe down the sides. He was barefoot. His hands were tied in front of him by rawhide strips cutting deep into the flesh of his wrists. He sagged, legs folding at the knees. He would have fallen if Sundog and Little Bells hadn't been holding him up. He was Butch Hardesty, a robber, rapist, and back-shooting murderer. He had a system. When the law got too hot on his trail, he would enlist in the army and disappear in the ranks, losing himself among blue-clad troopers and distant frontier posts. When the pursuit cooled off, he would steal a horse and rifle and go over the hill, deserting to resume his outlaw career. He'd go about his business until the law started dogging him again, once more repeating the cycle. In the last years of the war between the states, he worked his way west across the country, finally winding up at lonesome Fort Pardee in north-central Texas. He deserted again and had the extreme bad luck to cross paths with some of Red Hand's scouts. He'd been doubly unfortunate in being taken alive. He'd been beaten, starved, abused, and tortured near the extreme, but not all the way to destruction. Red Hand needed him alive. He had a use for him. Hardesty was taken north to the conclave at Arrowhead Rock, kept alive and on hand. For what? Out of the teepee stepped a weird hybrid creature, man-shaped with a monstrous shaggy horned head. Coming to the light, the apparition was revealed to be an aged Comanche, pot-bellied and thin-shanked. He wore a brown woolly buffalo hide headdress complete with horns. He was Medicine Hat, Red Hand's own shaman, herbalist, devil doctor, and sorcerer. Half carrying and half dragging Hardesty, Sundog and Little Bells hustled him to the front of the rock. Medicine Hat shambled after them, mumbling to himself. The cavalryman produced no small effect on the crowd, like a magnifying lens focusing the sun's rays into a single burning beam. The trooper provided a focus for the brave's bloodlust and demonic energies. Hardesty was brought to the stake and bound to it. Ropes made of braided buffalo hide strips lashed him to the pole with hands tied above his head. Too weak to stand on his own two feet, the ropes held him up. When Comanches took an enemy alive, they tortured him, expecting no less should they be taken. Torture was an important element of the warrior society. How a man stood up to it showed what he was made of. It was entertaining, too, to those not on the receiving end. Hardesty bore the marks of starvation and abuse. His face was mottled with purple-black bruises, features swollen, one blackened eye narrowed to a glinting slit. His mouth hung open. His shirt was ripped open down the middle, his bare torso having been sliced and gouged. Cactus thorns had been driven under his fingernails and toenails. Twigs had been tied between fingers and toes and set aflame. The soles of his feet had been skinned, then roasted. Firelight caused shadows to crawl and slide across Hardesty's bound form. He seemed as much dead as alive. Black Robe now went to work on him with a knife whose blade was heated red hot. Badger shot some arrows into Hardesty's arms and legs, careful to ensure that no wound was mortal. It was great sport. Hardesty was scum, and he knew it, but he played his string out to the end.
The joke's on you, you ignorant savages! I ain't cavalry at all! I'm a deserter! I quit the army, you dumb sons of bitches! How do you like that? You heathen devils!
A few Comanches had a smattering of English, but were unable to make out his words. All liked his show of spirit, however. Red Hand turned to the gathering.
The gods are happiest when the sacrifice is strong. Make ready for the Fire Lance.
Medicine Hat muttered agreement with a toothless mouth, spittle wetting his pointed chin. Reaching into his bag of tricks, he pulled out a gourd. It was dried and hollowed out, with a long neck serving as a kind of spout. The end of the spout was sealed by a stopper. Pulling the plug, he closed on the captive. Hardesty slumped against the ropes, head down, and chin resting on top of his chest. He looked up out of the tops of his eyes, his pain-racked gaze registering little more than a mute flicker of animal awareness. Red Hand moved forward, out of the shadows, into the light. It could be seen that his face was freshly striped with black paint. War paint, the sight of which sent an electric thrill surging through the throng. Red Hand motioned Medicine Hat to proceed. The shaman's moccasined feet shuffled in the dust, doing a little ceremonial dance. Mouthing spells, prayers, and incantations, Medicine Hat neared Hardesty, then backed away, repeating the action several times. He held the gourd over the captive's head and began pouring the vessel's contents on Hardesty's head, shoulders, chest, and belly, dousing him with a dark, foul-smelling liquid. Compounded of rendered animal fats, grease, and mineral oils, the stuff was used as a fire starter to quicken the lighting of campfires. Groans escaped Hardesty as his upper body was coated with the stuff. Medicine Hat poured until the gourd was empty. He stepped away from Hardesty, who looked as if he'd been drenched with glistening brown oil. Red Hand moved forward, the center of all eyes. The shaman was a great one for brewing up various potions, powders, and salves. Earlier, he had applied a special ointment to the spear blade of Red Hat's lance. The main ingredient of the mixture was a thick, sticky pine tar resin blended with vegetable and herbal oils. It coated the blade, showing as a gummy residue that dulled the brilliance of the steel's metallic shine. Holding the lance in both hands, Red Hand raised it horizontally over his head and shook it at the heavens. Lowering it, he dipped the blade into the heart of the fire. A few beats passed before the slow-burning ointment flared up, wrapping the blade in blue flames. Red Hand lifted the lance, tilting it skyward for all to see. The blade was a wedge of blue fire, burning with an eerie, mystic glow. A ghost light, a weird effect, both impressive and unnerving.
Lo! the Fire Lance!
He touched the burning spear to Hardesty's well-oiled chest. Blue fire sparked from the blade tip, leaping to the oily substance coating the captive's flesh. The fire-starting compound burst into bright, hot flames, wrapping Hardesty in a skin of fire. A human torch. Ah! He blazed with a hot, yellow-red-orange light. Fire cut through the ropes, binding Hardesty to the stake. Before he could break free, he was speared by Red Hand, who skewered him in the middle. Red Hand opened up Hardesty's belly, spilling his guts. He gave a final twist to the blade before withdrawing it. He faced the Man of Fire, lance leveled for another thrust if needed. Hardesty collapsed, falling in a blazing heap. The fire spread to some nearby grass and brush, setting them alight. At a sign from Red Hand, members of his five-man cadre rushed up with blankets, using them to beat out the fires. Streamers of blue-gray smoke rose up. The night grew thick with the smell of burning flesh. Red Hand thrust the blue-burning spear blade into a dirt mound. When it was removed, the mystic glow was extinguished, the blade glowing a dull red.
Take up the Fire Lance! Kill the Texans!
Much later, when all was quiet, Watonka and Laughing Bear stood off by themselves in a secluded place, putting their heads together. The horned moon hung low in the west, the stars paling, the eastern sky was lightening. Laughing Bear looked at Watonka.
What should we do?
Watonka looked into the creases of his palms as if they might hold an answer.
What can we do? Go with Red Hand to make war on the whites. Any raid is better than none.
That is true.
We shall see if the Great Spirit truly spoke to Red Hand, if his vision comes to pass. If not, may his bones bleach in the sand.
The town of Hangtree, county seat of Hangtree County, Texas, was known to most folks, except for a few town boosters and straight-laced respectable types, as Hangtown. So it was to Johnny Cross, a native son of the region. Located in north-central Texas, Hangtree County lay west of Palo Pinto County and east of the Llano Estacado, known as the Staked Plains, whose vast emptiness was bare of towns or settlements for hundreds of square miles. Hangtown squatted on the tip of that unbounded immensity. The old Cross Ranch lay some miles west of town, nestled at the foot of the eastern range of the Broken Hills, called the Breaks. Beyond the Breaks lay the beginnings of the Staked Plains. Johnny, the last living member of the Cross family, had come back to Hangtree after the war. He lived at the ranch with his old buddy Luke Pettigrew. Two not-so-ex-rebels trying to make a go of it in the hard times of the year following the fall of the Confederacy. They were partners in a Mustang venture. Hundreds of Mustangs ran wild and free in the Breaks, and Johnny and Luke sold whatever they could catch. Growing up in Hangtree, Johnny and Luke were boyhood pals. When war came in 1861, both were quick to fight for the South, like most of the menfolk in the Lone Star State. Luke joined up with Hood's Texans, a hard-fighting outfit that had made its mark in most of the big battles of the war. In the last year of the conflict, a Yankee cannonball had taken off his left leg below the knee. A wooden leg took its place. Johnny Cross had followed a different path. For good or ill, his star had led him to throw in with Quantrill's Raiders, legendary in its own way, though not with the bright, untarnished glory of Hood's fighting force. Johnny spent the next 4 years serving with that dark command, living mostly on horseback, fighting his way through the bloody guerrilla warfare of the border states. A dead shot when he first joined Quantrill, he soon became a formidable pistol fighter and long rider, a cool-nerved killing machine. His comrades in arms included the likes of Bloody Bill Anderson, the Younger Brothers, and Frank and Jesse James. The Bushwhackers' War in Kansas and Missouri was a murky, dirty business where the lines blurred between soldier and civilian, valor and savagery, and it was easy to lose one's way. When Richmond fell and Dixie folded in 65, Quantrill and his men received no amnesty. They were wanted outlaws with a price on their heads. On the dodge, plying the gunman's trade, Johnny Cross worked his way back to Hangtree County, where he wasn't wanted for anything. Yet. A dangerous place, the county was one of the most violent locales on the frontier. Trouble came frequently and fast, and Johnny was in his element. He and Luke crossed trails and teamed up. A mystery stranger named Sam Heller, a damned Yankee but a first-class fighting man, roped them into bucking a murderous outlaw gang. When the gun smoke cleared, Johnny and Luke could come out of it with whole skins and a nice chunk of reward money. Johnny and Luke saddled up and pointed their horses east along the Hangtree Trail, heading into town to blow off some steam after working hard during the week. Hangtown was a couple of hours' ride from the ranch, but then Texas was big. Every place in Texas was a fair piece away from everywhere else. They rode out in the morning when it was still cool. Texas in late June got hot early and stayed that way long after sundown. The Hangtree Trail was a dirt road stretching east-west across the county. It had rained the night before, washing things clean and wetting down the dust. The sky was cloudless blue, the grass and trees bright green. Luke Pettigrew was long and lean. War wounds left him hollow-eyed, sunken-cheeked, and gaunt. He was starting to fill out, but there was still something of a half-starved wolf about him. Tufts of gray-brown hair stuck out on the sides of his head under his hat, and the sharp tips of canine teeth showed over the edge of his lips. He was mounted on a big bay horse, a rifle fixed to the right-hand side of the saddle, and a crutch on the left. He was good with a rifle, fair with a pistol. A sawed-off shotgun hung in a holster on his right hip, for when the fighting got up close. Johnny Cross was of medium height, athletic, and compactly knit. He had black hair and hazel eyes that sometimes looked brown, sometimes yellow, depending on the light and his moods. He was clean-shaven, something of a rarity when most men wore beards or mustaches. When he'd been with Quantrill, he lived rough in the field, going weeks, months without a shave, haircut, or bath, and wearing the same clothes night and day until they began coming apart, shredding off his body. These days, he set a high value on bathing, shaving, and clean clothes. His nature was fastidious, cat-like even. He wore a flat-crowned black hat, a dark broadcloth jacket, and a gray button-down shirt. His black denim pants hung over his army-issue boots. A pair of hip-holstered Colt 44 showed beneath his jacket. A lightweight pistol was tucked away in one of his jacket pockets. A carbine was tucked into his saddle scabbard, and a couple more pistols were stashed in his saddlebags. Riding with Quantrill had taught him the value of having plenty of firepower where he could get to it fast. Returning to Hangtree firmed up that belief. Ahead lay a low ridge running north-south, cut at right angles by the Hangtree Trail. Hangtown lay just east of the rise. North of the trail rose the Hanging Tree, a towering dead oak, silver-gray and lightning-blasted. It had broken limbs sticking out from its sides. At its foot lay black stick-like crosses, slanting wooden grave markers, and the weedy mounds of Boot Hill, burial place of the poor, the lost, and the damned. South of the trail, the rise was topped by a white-painted wooden church with a bell tower topped by an obelisk-shaped steeple. Nearby was the churchyard cemetery, neat and well-kept. Johnny and Luke crested the ridge. On the far side, the trail dipped and ran east into Hangtown. Once in town, the road became Trail Street, the main drag. It was paralleled on the north by Commerce Street, on the south by Mace Street. At the east end of Trail Street stood the courthouse and the jail, Hangtown's only stone buildings, built in the 1850s. The courthouse fronted east, a two-story brown sandstone structure with a clock tower. The jail fronted north, its long walls running north-south, a one-story brick building with iron bars on the windows. South-central of town, a jumble of adobe houses and wooden huts grouped around an oval plaza, Mextown. Southwest of town stretched a grassy open field with a stream running through it. A wagon train was camped there, with more than 24 wagons arranged in a circle. Horses and oxen grazed nearby. Smoke rose from cooking fires. People moved to and fro, youngsters weaving in and out around them. Johnny and Luke rode down the ridge into town. It was a little past 10 o'clock in the morning. Saturdays were usually busy in Hangtown. Ranchers and their families from all over the county came in to trade, barter, or buy. The fine late June weather had brought them out in big numbers. Wagons lined boardwalk sidewalks, fronting the stores on both sides of Trail Street. Many cowboys and ranch hands worked only a half day on Saturday. They would start coming in after 12 noon, the week's wages burning holes in their pockets, itching to be spent on whiskey, women, and gambling. They stepped out of Mabel's Cafe after a fortifying breakfast, and Johnny reached into an inside breast pocket of his jacket for one of several long, thin cigars he kept there. He bit the end off, spat it out, and lit up. Luke used a penknife to cut a chaw off a plug of tobacco, stuck it in the side of his mouth, then commenced to work on it. They moved on, north to Trail Street. With his crutch wedged under his left arm, Luke swung along with the facility that comes with much practice. Men with missing limbs were a commonplace sight throughout the land in the war's aftermath. Johnny padded along at a nice easy pace so as not to get Luke winded. Besides, he was in no hurry. Turning left to Trail Street, they went west along its south side, nodding to acquaintances, saying hello in passing. Johnny liked to watch the passing parade, especially the pretty girls, the town misses and ranchers' daughters. They were bright-eyed with well-scrubbed, shining faces. Their wayward sisters, denizens of the saloons and the houses, were mostly still abed, not yet astir. Johnny liked them well enough, too. Perhaps too well. But they belonged to a half-world of gamblers, barkeeps, whores, hard cases, and thrill-seekers. Sinners all. They were nightbirds who flew when the sun went down. At 10:30 in the morning, respectable folk held sway, crowding the wooden plank sidewalks fronting the stores. Luke shook his head.
Phew! A lot of strangers in town.
Let's come from that wagon train, Major Adams' outfit.
Johnny pointed to the circle of wagons. The strangers were a rough-hewn lot, decent-seeming enough, but bearing the look of having done a lot of hard traveling with a long way yet to go. Some were staring, others shy, but all had the aspect of wayfarers, pilgrims.
Well, where are they going, Johnny?
West Danville Flats, and then across the plains to the Santa Fe Trail, I reckon.
And then?
Denver, or the mines in Arizona or Nevada. California, maybe. Who knows?
Damn fools. I mean, the ones taking the families with them.
Can't leave them behind.
Well, maybe not, but they got a hard road ahead. Lucky to make it without losing their hair.
Major Adams knows his business, they say.
They say?
His wagons have gotten through so far.
Not all of them. Injuns and outlaws, desert and mountains did for more than a few.
Well, now, that ain't the Major's fault. They knew their chances when they set out. Anyhow, what have they got to go back to? Most of them are Southerns. All they own is their wagons and what's in them.
Yeah, they're lucky Billy Yank left them that much.
They crossed the street to the Cattleman Hotel with its raised front porch and veranda. A half dozen wooden steps accessed it, with another such stairway leading down at the opposite end. Johnny and Luke went around it, walking in the street, fronting the structure.
You ever get a hankering to go wandering again, Johnny? See what's over the next hill, break new trails?
Not lately. I've been a rolling stone for a long time. I'd like to stay put for a while. You?
No, I can't say I got itchy feet, seeing as how I only got 1 foot left to get an itch on. Hangtown ain't nothing special to me, now that the rest of us Pettigrews is either dead or gone or moved on. But it'll do for now.
Why'd you ask, then?
Well, seeing them pilgrims got me to wondering, that's all.
Across the street was the Alamo Bar, a high-toned watering hole. Farther west, on the next block, was Lockhart's Emporium, the biggest general store in the county. A stout, middle-aged matron with a couple of kids clinging to her skirts stood outside the store. A lightweight, four-wheeled cart, drawn by a single horse, was drawn up alongside the boardwalk. A store clerk, laden with packages, came out the front door. He was young and thin, with a bookkeeper's green-shaded visor on his head. He wore a white bib apron over a long-sleeved striped shirt and pants. The bulky parcels, wrapped in brown paper and tied with string, were held in front of him, against his chest, piled so high that he couldn't see over them. He navigated by peeking around and to the side of them. He was followed by a young woman. She held two bundles by the strings, one in each hand, arms at her sides. Masses of dark brown hair were pinned up at the top of her head. She had wide, dark eyes, high cheekbones, and a well-formed, clean-lined face. In a yellow dress, she was slim, straight, and shapely. The store clerk and the young woman set the packages down in the back of the cart and went back into the store.
Oh, good-looking gal. Seems familiar somehow.
Well, that's Faye. Faye Lockhart, Hoss. Don't you recognize her?
She's filled out nicely since last time I saw her. I'd have bet she would have been long gone from Hangtown. She always talked about how much she hated it here and couldn't wait to leave.
Oh, she been gone, and now she's back, like you.
And you.
No staying away from Hangtown, is there? Calls you home. You know, Faye got married and moved away, but here she is, back at the same old stand.
Married to who?
Oh, some stranger named Devereaux, a cavalry officer. The way I heard it, they met when she was visiting kinfolk in Houston. He's on leave. Well, they courted in a whirl and got hitched. Well, he went back to join his troops, and he got killed a month or two later. Then Faye come back here to live with her folks.
Believe I'll go say hello to the widow.
Oh, now that'd be right sociable of you.
I'm a sociable fellow, Luke.
With a pretty girl you are.
True. You coming?
Luke shook his head.
She's your friend.
Yours too?
I knew her to say hello to back in the day. That's because I was a friend of yours. Elsewise, we moved in different circles. Them high and mighty Lockharts don't have no truck for us Pettigrews.
For the Crosses neither.
You and her got along pretty good, I do recall.
Kid stuff.
Well, she ain't no kid now.
I noticed.
Luke indicated some empty rocking chairs on the front porch of the Cattleman Hotel.
I'll sit there for a while. Take a load off.
Them stairs ain't gonna be a problem.
I can handle them.
I'll be along directly then.
Take your time. Tell Faye I said hello for what it's worth. If she even remembers me. Regrets about her dead husband and all, you know.
Sure.
Crossing the street, he climbed the three low wooden steps to the boardwalk. He took off his hat, running a hand through straight, longish black hair, pushing it back off his forehead and behind his ears. He put the hat back on, tilting it to a not-too-rakish angle. Unconsciously, he squared his shoulders. He went into Lockhart's Emporium for the first time in over 5 years. Owner Russ Lockhart, Faye's father, was absent from the premises. No doubt he was at the big table in the private dining room at the Cattleman Hotel, where his brother-in-law, town boss Wade Hutto, held court every Saturday morning, attended by Hangtown's gentry of bankers, merchants, and big ranchers. The Saturday morning meets were one of the few things that could entice Russ Lockhart out from behind the store's cash register. The store was busy, crowded with customers. Johnny didn't have to look hard to find Faye. She just naturally stood out from the rest as she showed a bonnet to a townswoman. Her Aunt Nell, a sour-faced old biddy, was helping out. A watchful young woman who kept a wary eye on the clientele, Faye glanced up to see who had entered. She saw a handsome, well-dressed young man about her own age, a not-so-usual sight that made her look twice.
Would you take care of Mrs. Gunderson, Aunt Nell? I'll only be a moment.
Not waiting for an answer, Faye put the bonnet down, scooting out from behind the counter and down the center aisle.
Johnny! Johnny Cross!
Howdy, Faye. Long time no see.
She reached out with both arms, taking his hands, squeezing them warmly. He couldn't help noticing a thin gold band circling the base of her ring finger, a wedding band. Unsure how to respond, he was a bit awkward. Faye leaned forward, kissing him lightly on the cheek. His skin tingled at the contact. Some free-falling strands of her hair brushed his face, smelling sweet, intoxicating. She stepped back, still holding his hands, looking him over.
It's so good to see you.
She released him, hands falling to her sides.
I heard you were back. I was wondering when we'd run into each other. Why didn't you come to see me sooner?
Well, I've been busy getting settled back at the ranch, you know, fixing the old place up.
You've been busy, all right. Everybody's talking about how you cleaned up that awful outlaw gang. You're a hero, Johnny.
Oh, don't believe everything you hear, Faye. These things are like fish stories. They get all puffed up in the telling. I just pitched in and helped out a little where I could, that's all.
It was a wonderful thing you did. Not a man or woman was safe with those killers on the loose.
Nice of you to say so, anyhow. I was sorry to hear about your loss, Faye. Your husband, that is. Real sorry.
Thank you, Johnny. Lamar, Captain Devereaux, was a gallant officer and a gentleman.
I'm sure.
You would have liked him.
Johnny wasn't so sure about that, but he nodded as if he was.
Who hasn't lost someone in the war? Your brother, Cal.
That's true. Cal didn't make it.
That's what I heard. Now it's my turn to say I'm sorry.
Well, thanks.
Behind the counter, Aunt Nell raised an eyebrow.
Faye! I could use some help here!
In a minute, Aunt Nell. I'm talking with an old friend.
Nell thrust her head forward, peering at the young man.
Johnny Cross. Land sakes, I didn't recognize you. It's the first time I ever saw you in clean clothes.
Nell!
And a good morning to you, ma'am.
Is it? We'll see.
So you're going to be staying in Hangtree?
For a while.
Good. I'm glad.
Faye smiled, putting the full force of her considerable personal appeal behind it. Johnny felt it all the way down to his toes as he became distantly aware of some kind of commotion brewing outside. People in the store started moving up front to see what it was all about. Muffled by distance, Johnny couldn't make out the words, but he didn't care for the man's tone. Something about it, some raw, ragging note of derision, made the back of his neck start to get hot. Faye frowned, glancing toward the storefront windows.
What's all that commotion?
Uh-oh. That's Hangtown for you. A fella can't even strike up a chat with a pretty girl on Saturday morning without gunplay breaking out.
Faye started toward the door. Others moved toward the storefront for a better look. Johnny, cat quick, rushed up the center aisle, smoothly interposing himself between Faye and the open doorway.
You want to be careful when bullets are flying, Faye. Best wait here where it's safe. I'll go take a look.
But Johnny, do you...
Johnny was out the door before she could finish her thought. The street ahead was empty and folks scrambling for the sidelines and shelter. Men came out of the hotel lobby and dining room in a rush to see what was happening. They stood flattened behind upright pillars, crouched behind rocking chairs, peeking around corners. Staring oval faces clustered at the front entrance, others pressed against the windows. Johnny found Luke leaning for support against a porch column.
Hey, Luke.
You're just in time for the show.
Two men faced off in the square where a side street met Trail Street. They were at opposite ends of the square, one at the northeast corner, the other at the southwest, facing each other across the diagonal.
Bliss Stafford's gunning for Damon Bolt. Called him out.
Another man crouched on one knee, peering between the bars of the porch rail.
He must be crazy.
Crazy drunk.
I seen it all. Damon was going to the barbershop when young Stafford ran out of the hotel and drew on him.
He must have been inside laying for him.
Damon Bolt was the owner of the Golden Spur, a saloon and gambling hall frequented by a fast, hot-blooded sporting crowd. A riverboat gambler from New Orleans, he'd come west after the war, settling in Hangtown. Johnny knew him casually. He liked the man, what he'd seen of him, liked the way he handled himself. Bliss Stafford was unknown to him. It was the first time he'd heard the name. Stafford stood with his back to the hotel. Hatless, he showed a mop of yellow-gold curls. His expensive clothes were rumpled and wrinkled as though he'd slept in them. He crouched with a smoking gun in his right hand, swaying as though reeling under a wind only he could sense. Opposite him stood Damon Bolt. His right hand rested near the butt of a holstered gun worn low on the right hip. He was tall and thin, almost gaunt, with a high, pale forehead and deep-set dark eyes. The hair on his head and his mustache were raven black. He wore a brown morning coat, red cravat, tan waistcoat, and brown pants. His neat, small feet were encased in shiny brown boots. He seemed calm and self-possessed, oblivious of being under a drawn gun. Bliss Stafford circled around to one side, angling for a better line of fire on Damon. Johnny nudged Luke.
Who's this here Stafford?
Stafford family came in last year. Ranchers, hard-nosed bunch. Bought up some prime land on the South Fork. Ramrod Ranch, they call it. They got more gun hands than cow hands riding for the brand. Bliss is the youngest, the baby of the family. Mean drunk, and not much better sober.
He must be a damn fool calling out Damon Bolt.
Walk soft, strangers. Bliss has killed his man and more. All the Staffords have. Bad outfit to buck.
I'll take my chances, but thanks for the advice.
I'm calling you out, gambler!
Now, I have no quarrel with you, Stafford.
I got a quarrel with you. You should never have got between me and Francine.
This hardly seems a time or place to bandy words about a lady, sir.
Things were fine between us until you horned in.
You are mistaken, sir. Miss Hayes has made it clear your attentions to her are unwelcome.
You're a liar!
Damon shook his head, seeming more in sorrow than in anger, almost pitying the young man.
You're a fine one with all your fancy talk, making out like you're a real southern gentleman. You ain't fooling nobody. Everybody in town knows what you are. A four-flushing tin horn and whoremonger.
Have a care, sir. Say what you will about me, but I don't care to hear the ladies in my employ being abused.
Oh, you don't, huh? Yeah? What are you gonna do about it?
You the one with the gun. What are you gonna do?
I'm gonna kill you.
A man stood at the head of a press of spectators thronging the front entrance of the hotel. He pushed forward, starting across the porch. He wore a broad-brimmed hat, good clothes, and shiny boots. He was 50-ish, trim, with a handsome head of silver hair, a neatly trimmed mustache, and the beginnings of a double chin. He was Wade Hutto, a powerful man in the town and the county. He descended the front stairs into the street, circling around into the intersection. Moving at a measured pace, he approached the face-off from the side, showing himself to both men, yet careful not to get between them. Johnny nudged Luke with an elbow.
Looks like the bull of the woods is sticking his horns in.
There must be something in it for him. Oh, Wade don't stick his neck out for nothing.
What the devil are you two playing at?
Ask Stafford. He threw down on me.
You got a gun? Use it.
Put that gun away, Bliss.
Like hell! This is no business of yours, Hutto. Back off before you get hurt.
Everything that happens in Hangtree is my business, you young jackanapes.
You might throw some weight with these toothless townmen, but nobody tells Bliss Stafford what to do.
Vince might see it different.
Yeah, well, Pa ain't here now.
A good thing for you he's not. Otherwise, he'd knock some sense into you. I've got a lot of respect for Vince. Too much to let you go off half-cocked and get yourself into bad trouble, Bliss.
I kicked over the traces a long time ago. Now I do what I please, and it pleases me to give this tin horn what he's got coming to him.
Hutto turned to Damon.
Maybe I can get a straight answer out of you, Bolt. What's this all about?
It's about my girl, Francine. Damon's trying to keep me from her, keep us apart. That's why he's got to die.
You're playing with fire, Bliss. Vince told you to forget about Francine Hayes.
Oh, what does Paul know about it? He's old. I'm young. I got blood in my veins. Hot blood, not ice water. Francine belongs to me. She's mine. Slap leather, gambler.
Oh, against a drawn gun? I think not.
Bliss Stafford thought that one over. From his deeply lined brow and fierce frown, it could be seen that thinking was hard work for him. Coming to a decision, he shoved his gun back in the holster.
There. Now we're even up. The odds good enough for you now? There's nothing to stop you from reaching. Why don't you draw?
It's too nice a morning for killing.
Draw, damn you!
Now you see how it is, don't you, Hutto? Ain't no reasoning with the boy.
Boy? Oh, who you calling boy? You see a boy around here, kill him. Because I surely mean to kill you.
Don't do it, Bolt.
You're my witness, Hutto. You and everyone else here. Now, I gave him every ounce.
Enough talk! I count to three and then I'm coming up shooting.
You're making a big mistake, Bliss.
One.
You still got time to back off and save yourself.
Two.
Shooting me down, then.
Three.
Bliss jerked as a slug tore into his chest. The impact spun him around halfway, his leveled gun unfired. Damon's gun was held hip high, pointed at Bliss. A puff of gun smoke hovered around the muzzle. Bliss looked surprised. He crossed gazes with Hutto, whose face showed pity mingled with contempt, but no surprise. Bliss toppled, falling sideways into the dirt. Hurrying west on Trail Street, too late, came Sheriff Mac Barton and Deputy Clifton Smalls. Damon stepped back. Turning, he covered the newcomers with his gun. The lawmen slowed to a halt. Barton, in his mid-40s, had a face like the butt end of a smoked ham. A wide, straight torso hung down from broad, sloping shoulders. His legs were short and bandy. He wore a dark hat, gray shirt, black string tie, and a thin black vest with a tin star pinned over the right breast. A Colt 45 was holstered on the right hip of a well-worn gun belt. He stayed alive for a long time by not rushing into things blindly. He was not about to start now. Deputy Smalls was tall, thin, and reedy, stork-like. His gun stayed holstered, too. He took his cue from his boss. Wade Hutto hauled from his jacket pocket a handkerchief the size of a dinner napkin and mopped his face with it. He'd sweated plenty during the face-off.
Nice work, Sheriff. You managed to get here too late to stop it.
Few dared talk to Barton in that tone, including Hutto, except when he was rattled, as he was now.
You got no call to speak to me like that, Wade.
Hutto had put Barton in as sheriff. For most intents and purposes, he was Hutto's man. But Barton had a stubborn maverick streak that showed itself when he was crowded. He was a real son of Texas. There was no sense in getting on his bad side any time, but especially with a potential crisis brewing.
You're right, of course, Sheriff. I spoke out of turn in the heat of the moment. Sorry.
That's all right.
This is a hell of a mess.
Damon eased his gun into the holster, hand loitering not too far from the gun butt. Barton motioned to the deputy.
Might as well inspect the damage.
Barton and Smalls edged around the body, Hutto joining them. Bliss Stafford lay twisted on the ground, upper body turned face up. A dark red hole marked his left breast. Barton glanced down at the body, making his quick, expert appraisal.
Dead.
Deader than hell.
Hutto turned to Damon.
You went and did it. You couldn't just wing him. Oh, no, you had to kill him. Now it's Katie bar the door. Oh, there'll be hell to pay when Vince hears of this. Why didn't you shoot the gun out of his hand or just wound him?
Well, who do you think I am, Bill Hickok?
You got him right through the heart. I call that pretty fair shooting.
Damon shrugged. Barton took off his hat and scratched his head.
What happened?
I was on my way to Lauder's Tonsorial Parlor for a shave and a haircut when Bliss came gunning for me. I wouldn't draw, but he fired on me anyway.
What for did he have a mat on? As if I didn't know.
Things finally came to a head over the Hayes gal.
Francine Hayes?
If that's her name, yes.
Don't bull me, Wade. You know her name. We all do. Francine Hayes. Lord knows Bliss and Vince have been kicking up a ruckus about her lately. Little slip of a gal got Bliss all tied up in knots so he couldn't think straight. Not that he ever was much one for using his head.
Bliss wanted Miss Hayes to run off and elope with him. That's impossible, of course, even if she was willing, which she wasn't. Vince would never stood for it. He even sent his son Clay around to buy her off. Now, Francine was willing about that, but Bliss was having none of it. He threatened to kill his own brother if he tried to interfere. But Francine held out, for which Bliss blamed me. He thought if I was out of the way, he'd have a clear field.
Damon looked around at the various witnesses and rubberneckers hemming in the scene.
You all saw it. Bliss would have it his way. Left me no choice. I had to defend myself.
Maybe, but that won't cut no ice with Vince.
I can stand it.
You only think you can.
Damon looked at him. Hutto was first to break eye contact, looking away.
Clear-cut case of self-defense, Sheriff. Everybody saw it.
How many will swear to it at the inquest, though?
The milling crowd shrank back, sheepish, none meeting the lawman's eyes.
Anybody?
I will.
Johnny Cross stood at the porch rail. Barton stood with fists on hips, looking up at him.
Now, why does that not surprise me?
Johnny shrugged. He and the sheriff had a history, going back to Johnny's boyhood days when Barton was deputy.
I reckon we still got the right of self-defense in this country. That Stafford fellow was on the prod, spoiling for a fight. Damon did what he had to do. I would have done the same. So would any man here. That's how I'll tell it in court.
Me too.
Just a couple of public-spirited citizens, huh?
You know us, Sheriff. Always ready to help out the law.
You only been back for a month or two, so you might not be up to date yet. What do you know about Vince Stafford and his ramrod outfit?
Not a thing.
A bad bunch to mess with.
That's supposed to make a difference to me?
Not you. You're too ornery.
Barton turned to Luke.
You got no excuse, though. You've been back long enough to know the way of things.
I ain't worried, Sheriff. I got you to protect me.
Yeah? Who's gonna protect me?
Deputy Smalls?
You boys don't give a good damn about nothing, do you? I like your nerve, if nothing else. It's your funeral. Don't say I didn't warn you.
Duly noted.
Bolt turned to the sheriff.
I'm free to go.
Free as air. If you're smart, you'll keep going. Long way from here.
Well, that's not my style, Sheriff.
No, it wouldn't be. You'd rather stay and get killed.
Well, I'd rather stay.
We won't argue.
You know where to find me for the inquest.
If you're still alive. Ben Stafford knows where to find you, too.
Uh-huh. I'll be waiting.
Damon nodded to Johnny and Luke.
Y'all stop by the spur late. I'll buy you a drink.
It's a go.
Luke nodded assent. Damon went up the street to the barbershop and went inside.
Decent fellow at that.
Too bad he's got to die.
Spectators gathered around the body of Bliss Stafford, gawking, buzzing. Deputy Smalls plucked at Barton's sleeve.
Somebody's got to tell Vince.
You want to be the one to tell him his pup is dead?
Oh, no thanks.
He'll find out soon enough. No doubt somebody's already on the way to the ranch to give him the word.
Good news always travels fast.
Careful, somebody might hear you.
At this point, who gives a damn?
I do.
Hutto gripped Barton's upper arm and led him off to one side for a private chat.
Somebody was bound to burn down Bliss Stafford sooner or later. He was a troublemaker and a damned nuisance.
Good riddance.
Too bad it was the gambler. Some lone hand done it, some drifter, we could step back and wash our hands of it. But it ain't some nobody, it's Damon Bolt. He'll fight.
He's got friends, too. Gunhawks. He'll make a mouthful for Vince at that. Hard to swallow.
I hope he chokes on it.
Those Staffords have been getting too big for their britches. Trouble is, the town's in the way. Hangtown could get pretty badly torn up.
No way to stop it. We'll have blood. Vince won't rest till he's taken Damon's head.
It's a damn shame, Mac. Say what you will about Bolt, he's a gentleman in his way. Vince makes a show of setting himself up as a rancher, but he's little better than an outlaw.
He's a dog, a mangy cur, one with a taste of blood in his mouth.
Why not bring him to heel?
Hutto and Barton started. Soft-footed Johnny had come up behind them without their knowing it.
You shouldn't go sneaking up on people. It's a bad habit.
How much did you hear?
Enough, and that's plenty. But I don't go telling tales out of school. Stafford's crowding you? Cut him down to size.
Hutto looked around to make sure nobody else was within earshot. Luke Pettigrew stood nearby, leaning on his crutch, grinning. But Luke was Johnny's side man and knew how to keep his mouth shut, too.
The Ramrod outfit is a tough bunch.
No shortage of gunmen in Hangtown.
But they've got no quarrel with Stafford.
Pay them. They'll fight readily enough. There's enough hard cases in the Dog Star Saloon alone for a decent-sized war, and you can buy most of them for a couple bottles of red-eye.
What's Damon Bolt to me that I should start a range war with the Ramrod to save his neck?
Stafford Spread is on the South Fork of the Liberty River. You're the biggest landowner on the South Fork. How long before he makes a move on you?
He wouldn't dare.
And why not?
Hutto had no ready answer to that one.
Why let him pick the time and place? Hit him now before he hits you.
Your concern for my welfare is touching. What's in it for you?
I like Damon. He'll fight. Round up enough guns to hit Stafford where he's not expecting it, and you can muss him up pretty good. The way to stop him is to bust him up before he gets started.
We'd be taking a long chance.
It's your town. but it won't be for long if you let somebody hoorah it whenever he likes.
I need time to think things out.
Think fast, move faster.
Just itching for a fight, ain't you?
Uh-huh. That's what I do.